Joining us now live is the man who will, we assume, soon be confirmed as the new permanent chief of the city of Seattle, Chief Adrian Diaz. First of all, congratulations. And I think what people want to know is you've served during a pretty tumultuous time since the riots of 2020. What has changed since those days when the precinct was abandoned and morale was low? Do you have confidence that the police department can get back to where it was in terms of gaining community trust?
Yeah, so over the last 2 years, we've had to deal with, we lost an officer that was killed in the line of duty. We've had to deal with the defund movement. We've had to deal with the vaccine mandate. We've had to deal with, a loss of our canine officer. So many different challenges, and our officers are really focused on getting back to doing police work. The staffing challenge is one of the biggest hurdles. We have just launched our recruiting and hiring plan. But the next piece is really trying to make sure that our officers have a good comprehensive package for retaining our officers, and that is really one of the things that we're focused on.
What would it take to hire the number of officers you need and retain those who have been working for the force?
So right now, we have about 350 people that could retire at any given time. And so as we hire people, we have to make sure that we have built in a buffer for those that are potentially going to retire. So I think it's going to take us a number of years to get up to what I believe is full staffing of 1,400 plus officers. I would probably say it's going to take 5 to 7 years, but this retention and retention component and then the hiring, recruiting and hiring plan will hopefully help us get there sooner. And I would love to see us within about 3 to 4 years being fully staffed.
Be honest about what it's like to be a police officer right now. Is it as bad as it seems with people turning their backs on those in blue, or do you think morale is up these days?
Well, I do think morale is up these days from the last couple of years. I mean, we have to understand that 2 years ago, people were yelling and screaming. People were, flipping officers off. It was not a very good environment for officers. And many people left not only to go to other departments, but they actually left the profession completely. And so I do think that it's gotten a lot better. Officers are starting to feel a lot more welcome. They're doing a lot more stuff in the community. But one of the challenges, I actually was just on an accident scene just the other day with officers, and a person got hit by a car. And so we're dealing with the situation, and somebody on a stroller just started cussing at the officers. And so you do have those random acts that people just still frustrated with police officers. And officers weren't doing anything wrong. They were literally just trying to attend to a victim that had been hit by a car. So,
And what about at City Hall? Is the defund movement over, or do you still find yourself having to beg for more officers?
We're not begging for more officers. I mean, I think we've been able to get our fully, funded recruiting and hiring plan. We have to make sure that we are working and negotiate a good contract to keep and retain our people. But there is, when we're in budget talks, there's going to be all sorts of different discussions about, potentially cutting money from the police department. I'm trying to make sure that I maintain the whole budget, because there's so many different things in related to public safety that we need. We need to have investments in technology, because when we don't have officers, we need to find efficiencies. And so I'm hoping to retain every aspect of our budget, and that's what's going to be one of the challenges moving forward.
I know that your focus is to retain officers and hire, but no doubt what we've learned over the last couple of years is that there are bad apples, just like there are in any career. Certainly there are journalists out there who don't act in good faith. What systems have you put in place to weed those bad apples out? We know about the blue curtain. We know about the back the blue. It is very hard to get people off the force who may be abusing their power.
So, I have taken, I've had to reset the kind of our accountability structure, or when it comes to discipline. I've terminated close to 24 terminations since my time, which is the most of any chief that I know of that I've ever heard of. And a part of that is I keep it very simple. Don't lie, don't be racist, and don't commit crime. And, I've held people accountable to those standards. Right now, I've also had to discipline officers for all sorts of different violations. But really, I also want to make sure that that there's a couple things. We put officers sometimes where officers are working two multiple shifts every single day, every single week. And we also can't put them in an environment where we create an environment of stress and just a level of trauma. And so we also have to make sure that we're investing in our officers and putting the investments in wellness. And so that's the balance, is making sure, because we know that a healthy officer will have healthy outcomes to the community. And so it's that balance that we need to do, investing in our officers as well as holding our officers accountable when they do wrong.
Obari Salisbury was on with us earlier, and he said he is still not satisfied with the amount of violence in his community, the amount of violence that he grew up with in the Central District, and that the rest of the city really doesn't care about some neighborhoods as long as it's not in their neighborhood. So how do you address that?
You know, I couldn't agree more with Omari on this, because, you know, I have worked in on youth violence issues since, you know, 2004. I've seen the violence and I've seen, you know, where it spikes a little bit and, you know, the community really rallies around. But we're at all time, like 25-year highs in homicides. We're coming into the area where we've had the most shots fired of the last 12 years. And we really do need to rally our all of our efforts to make sure that we reduce these shootings and get more guns off the street. We're going to recover almost the same amount of guns that we had in 2019 when we had full staffing. So officers are going out, doing the hard work, trying to make sure that they take guns off the street, that they try to make arrests in these cases. But we really need, you know, a huge level of investment through city services and other entities to really help create that shared responsibility to address the violence.
Are the neighborhoods helping you? I mean, or are there people there when you go into a neighborhood that's beset by this kind of violence? They say, "You're a cop. I don't trust you."
No, I mean, I think for the most part, most of our communities are actually very engaged in trying to reduce the violence. But the problem is that they also know that they need more officers. And that's, I think that's going to be our driving force over the next couple of years, is really trying to have the officers at the right place at the right time. And just over the last couple of weeks, we've, you know, been, you know, kind of focused on redeployment and emphasis. And we've actually seen some of our violent crime drop down over the last couple of weeks. And so we're hoping that we're starting to work on those, find those solutions after the summer months.
The man will become the new permanent police chief of the city of Seattle, Adrian Diaz. Thank you for coming on, and good luck.
Thank you so much. Take care.
The Empire Builder made his point with the Great, Great Northern Railway. From Chicago to Seattle.
Oh, is this a new Amtrak campaign?
A lot of telling rather than showing going on in those lyrics, which are, and this song that we're just, is not related to what we're talking about this morning, other than in subject matter. I want to point that out. Okay.
Here is our resident historian, Felix Bonnell, Mr. History himself, with a new documentary about James J. Hill, who's the founder of the Great Northern Railway, and who many consider to be one of the most consequential figures in Northwest history. This documentary is going to premiere later this month. So you talked to the filmmaker. First of all, you're brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. You talked to the filmmaker. Why is James J. Hill so important?
Well, you know, you can't really overstate the importance of the railroad in the 19th century in terms of economic expansion and linking the country together culturally and politically. And that economic part is still true to this day, as that recent threat of a railroad strike showed just last week. But this new four-hour documentary called The Empire Builder is about more than just the railroad. Now, I don't like it when someone tries to compare people from different eras, saying like Rupert Murdoch is the Genghis Khan of the 2000s or whatever. Now, Stephen Sadis, he's made a number of local documentaries, like about the Seattle Rainiers, about the old interurban railroad. So I asked him to make a comparison to the main character in his new documentary. And when he said Bill Gates is like the James J. Hill of his time, I thought Hill sounded more like Jeff Bezos.
King Street Station, down at the south end of the city.
Wait, that's not the one we're going to play. We're going to play the correct one there. Sorry about that.
You know, actually, that might be a better analog. Bezos went in with the idea that we're going to lose money for the first 25 years, but he's going to build market share. And Hill was a big advocate of seeing different markets, finding out that there are rate pooling or price fixing agreements among railroad and steamship companies, and he would go in there and figure out if he could undercut them. And that is what he did time after time after time, reducing rates by 20, 23% sometimes. And so he was all about volume. He was all about greater tonnage, lower fares. And so yeah, Bezos, good call.
That great men of history model, it's sometimes discredited for oversimplifying stories about the past, but James J. Hill seems to be an exception. You know, he was born in Canada in 1838. He was the founder of the Great Northern Railway in the late 19th century, and that's the route that came over Stevens Pass and that boosted Seattle by choosing it for its terminus. It's a complex story. Again, this is a four-hour documentary. It goes from Hill's modest upbringing to his rise in St. Paul, Minnesota as a young shipping clerk to creating that railroad and building a route across the country. One of the only railroads to do it without government subsidy. He didn't take the land grants, well, all the other guys did. And the only transcontinental railroad to never declare bankruptcy. Now, Hill impacted the Northwest in many ways. He did things like help develop the apple industry in Wenatchee, and then lowered rates to create a market for Northwest lumber on the other side of the country. And he altered the built environment in ways that still affect where we live. We've talked here before about that 1904 railroad tunnel that still runs under downtown. Hill gets credit for how that cleaned up the waterfront and made it easier for rail and the growing urban core to coexist. Now, I'm personally partial to that 1914 Salmon Bay Bridge west of the locks. That's in the process of being preserved. That's where I actually met up with Stephen Sadis the other day. And Stephen has his own favorite James J. Hill landmark.
King Street Station, down at the south end of the city, was built in 1906, and while I was reading about it, I had no idea that it's almost an exact duplicate of the Campanile in Venice. And I also didn't know that that used to be the tallest structure in the whole city before the Smith Tower.
Yeah, so it's this elegant tower that looks just like the bell tower in Italy. And it actually was the tallest building for 8 years before the Smith Tower caught up in 1914. And the Smith Tower held that until 1962 when the Space Needle usurped it. Now, Hill was also a pretty progressive thinker and clearly a brilliant guy. And that made an impact in the Northwest. Stephen Sadis says Hill gave a way ahead of its time speech at the 1909 Alaska Pacific Yukon Exposition. That was a World's Fair that was held on the UW campus.
He tells the people of the Northwest, he says, this is the last bastion of resources, natural resources, this country has. What are you going to do with your soil? What are you going to do with your salmon? What are you going to do with your timber? What are you going to do to preserve these things? Because his experience was that he'd seen the Midwest be devastated. And the crazy thing about it is in 1909, he mentions climate change as a result of these clear-cutting practices. And so this is a fellow who had access to a lot of data. He had a photographic memory and absorbed all this stuff, translated it, and forecasted it better than anyone.
Yeah, it's everyone paid heed to what he said, and everything turned out great.
Yeah,
and here we are,
say.
And if there's no smoke outside this morning, it's a beautiful day.
Well, if only we just stuck with railroads instead of moving to cars, it'd be fine. Right?
Exactly. Now, there's still a big statue of James J. Hill on campus, left over from 1909. The bottom line really is that the Empire Builder shows how Hill is still justifiably a larger-than-life character. You know, he even found his way into great American literature. After the new film was completed, Stephen Sadis rode on a train, the Empire Builder, the cross-country train named after Hill, from St. Paul all the way to Portland, with 20 of Hill's descendants to preview the entire production.
After watching one of the episodes, which has the quote on it from F. Scott Fitzgerald, it says, if Gatsby had lived, he would have been a great man. He'd have been like James J. Hill and would have built up this country. And this kid comes up to a relative of his and he said, I just finished reading The Great Gatsby and I had no idea that my great-great-grandfather is being compared to Jay Gatsby. And for him to put that together, that was kind of rewarding.
Yeah, and Hill's death was in May 1916, was front page news in Seattle, and his adopted hometown of St. Paul shut down for his funeral. The film's going to be, you can order it as a DVD now, it'll be online next week. I'm also going to hold out for the Hollywood adaptation, where I think Colin Farrell will play Isaac Stevens in the opening sequence of Isaac Stevens mapping the railroad route across the country. But it really is it's not just for railroad buffs. It's a great story about America and about the Northwest.
Were you standing at the locks or something?
Yeah, it's the bells ringing and everything. We were looking over the bridge there, the Salmon Bay Bridge that James J. Hill had a hand in building right there.
I thought somebody's alarm clock was going on.
The seagull. Yeah, I added the seagull effects later just to give it that ambiance.
That's very nice. Historian Felix Bunnell, all his features at mynorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Ed.
6:48, Seattle's Morning News. Putin has made his move. He's called up 300,000 trained reservists, presumably to recapture those liberated parts of Ukraine and continue the war. Let's go to CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. This sounds like a pretty major escalation to me. So where does this lead?
Well, this leads, Dave, I think you're exactly right. It is escalatory in two ways. One, the call of the forces that you suggest, but also the rattling of the nuclear saber. He talked about the threat to use nuclear weapons to defend the Russian homeland. And he also talked about these nuclear powerpoints. So it's clearly a response to the setbacks Mr. Putin has suffered, not only on the battlefield, that counteroffensive, which has now seized more territory by the Ukrainians in 2 weeks than the Russians seized in the last 5 months, but also these amazing, I think, in some ways, diplomatic setbacks that he suffered, with really very, very little support being provided publicly by President Xi, in many ways a criticism by President Modi of India during that recent meeting they had in Uzbekistan.
Okay, so he's alone, but I thought the conventional wisdom was that it would be too controversial, even for a dictator, to call up the reserves like this, that there would be a rebellion in his country. But that hasn't happened, has it?
Not so far, at least, but this is no doubt a very, very dangerous move domestically that he's making. We the reports coming out of Moscow right now that all flights leaving Moscow and leaving Russia internationally are booked, as many young men in particular seem to be now fleeing the country. But it's a response in part to the criticism Putin's been receiving on the right wing in Russia, the very right wing nationalistic xenophobic media, TV, radio, that's been critical of the setbacks they suffer on the battlefield, critical of the senior military and defense leadership team, and some suggestions even critical of Putin. We had 50 municipal leaders sign a letter calling for Putin to, in fact, resign. In many cases, these are people who actually want him to do more. So this exploitation domestically, while the possibility of setting off more domestic unrest is there, also is a response to kind of quiet down those clamors that he's getting on the right.
What is the approach right now from the rest of the world, from the U.S. to other supporting countries? Is it just allow Putin to peter out because he can't handle this war? Or will more force come from Ukraine allies?
I think we'll see a proportionate response, frankly, from the West. I think it's going to be very interesting to listen to President Biden's remarks at the U.N. General Assembly in the next hour and what he has to say. We've seen already some speeches being given at the U.N., President Macron being very outspoken and publicly calling for a more broad support for opposition to Putin's move in Ukraine, and really calling out a lot of what we call the global South, countries in South Asia like India, countries in Africa, the Middle East, et cetera, who have tacitly accepted the Russian invasion, or at least largely tried to ignore it, calling them out that you can hardly have an international system. Do you think we're going to come help you if, in fact, you were to experience the same type of aggression by a large country on your border?
What contains this? What prevents it from expanding? I see Lithuania putting its rapid reaction force on alert. European countries can't be happy about this. What keeps this confined to Ukraine and prevents it from becoming a European war?
Yeah, that's a $64 question. How do you try to keep this confrontation from spreading and moving up the escalatory ladder? And I've always said, unfortunately, that we were at the greatest nuclear confrontation we've experienced since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and sadly that's now being unfolded before our very eyes. The restraints are, one, it's a big game of poker. If you respond, who's going to back down? And in the essence, wars come to a conclusion when one side or the other changes their objectives. And that's right now, who's going to change their objectives first, Putin or us? It's also a function we talked about a moment ago. Does he start to perceive more and more opposition in Russia, making his situation at home more tenable, and then looks for some kind of an off-ramp? But right now, there's no doubt about it. We are at a very, very dangerous moment in the possibility of further confrontation east and west.
So there's no back channel negotiations, nobody offering a plausible face-saving way out for Putin?
We don't know of any that are ongoing. Hopefully there are some. I think the one person that I would like to talk to the most in some ways right now would be President Xi, and have set in on the private conversations that he had between him and Putin on the periphery of that meeting last week. I can't believe that President Xi is very happy about this announcement by Putin this morning, that's threatening to use nuclear weapons. I thought it was interesting. In fact, there was a vote taken on whether or not to allow President Zelensky to speak by Zoom to the UN General Assembly. Only six nations opposed that, Russia obviously being one of them. India voted in favor of letting Zelensky speak, and the Chinese abstained. So once again, I think Xi might play a very important role, because I think he's seeing this war as being more and more counterproductive in terms of the possibility of escalation, in terms of overall world economic impact, which also affects his country, and a lot of domestic challenges he has at home.
CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Dave.
The man who took over as interim Seattle police chief in the middle of the 2020 protests over racial injustice is now the city's permanent police chief. Adrian Diaz was named to the position by Mayor Bruce Harrell yesterday. And during the news conference, Omari Salisbury of Converge Media specifically asked the new chief to speak to his commitment to policing the black community. And here's what he said.
I'm committed to making sure that our communities of color are not experiencing the death of a loved one, that they're not experiencing, you know, potential stops that, you know, create disparate impacts in the community. And so I'm committed to making sure that we put policies in place, training in place, that we hold people accountable for their actions. But we also make sure that we value the hard work that our officers are doing every single day to making sure that people that live to see another day.
And Amari is with us now live. What did you think of his response, Amari?
I can say this about Chief Diaz, is that Chief Diaz has actually been engaged in the black community for a while, you know what I'm saying, for his time on the force. So I didn't, like, not believe what he was saying, because he has been doing those things. But, I mean, we'll see, you know, where a lot of this ends up going, you know, where if is especially along the commitment around, you know, engaging community more in policing. So we'll see what he does.
I mean, have you seen changes on the ground that, you know, make you think, yeah, things are getting better?
Well, what I have seen is that, you know, in community, one thing that has happened is community itself is really stepping up more, you know, as usual, to be able to fill any kind of voids. You know, we haven't seen, of course, anything like close to what we saw back in 2020 or anything else. So I wouldn't say that, I would say that the partnership with community and how community is wanting to fill voids in non-police response, we are seeing some of that, which is a good thing.
And Hannah Scott is also with us now live. Just for people who don't know, Omari Salisbury with Converge Media was in the center of their protests. So was Hannah. They're both intimately familiar with what went on and why their response made things go bad. Hannah, what did you think of the announcement?
I thought, as I told you when we spoke about the three finalists a week or so ago, Dave, that I personally expected that Chief Diaz would get the nod here. I think he's done a lot of really good things. I think it was Manisha Harrell, deputy mayor, who said yesterday one of the reasons that they picked him was because he could have been a lame duck, right? He could have done nothing the last 2 years, and instead he did not. And Amari, I know, you've had him on as a guest talking specifically about gun violence, really engaging with the community, and I know that's a priority for both you and folks in the Central District with all the shootings we've seen there. What is it that you're hearing from folks in the Central District and in the black community about this pick?
Well, I would say this, right? I would say a few things. That first of all, in the Central District of Seattle, Seattle's black community has been dealing with the issue of gun violence and violence as a whole and crime for decades. And so, you know, it's always a misnomer to think that we don't want safe streets and we don't want safe communities. It's just when in Seattle as a city, is as long as these things don't impact other neighborhoods, people have had no problem with gun violence and crime and everything else in the city of Seattle because it didn't touch their neighborhood. It wasn't in their backyard. You know, I was 9 years old in the Central District. Somebody got stabbed and killed in my front yard. When I was in high school, one of my friends got murdered. My son graduated from O'Day 4 years ago. One of his friends, Connor Dawson Holland, murdered, like, his generational. So I just want to put that out there. But this is something we've continuously dealt with and continuously been ignored. I will say that people who are in the advocacy space, people who try to disrupt gun violence, you know, they found an advocate in Chief Diaz, now Chief Diaz, well before he became chief. Because, you know, he's worked in these different units in the Central District and the South End since back when he was a sergeant. So, you know, that's there. The other side of this is, though, is that will he actually be able to make any fundamental changes in his department because he has been there so long? And we've seen before with Chief Best that the command staff at times has no problem working against the best interest of the chief or the people of the city of Seattle.
So what needs to change then at this point? I mean, to stop that cycle of violence, you have to have a community that trusts the cops and will say, hey, so-and-so, I'm pretty sure, is about to shoot so-and-so. Do something about it.
Well, I mean, this is the thing, though, right? And this is what we find right now, is that really to be able to impact the cycle of violence altogether, it requires more than police. If you look at our neighborhood, look at our community, irregardless of staffing numbers, a lot of times it's violence has stayed at a certain level. We have to address the root issues, the root causes. And a lot of these programs are there because you know what happens, Dave? If somebody gets shot, you have a group like, say, the regional peacekeepers or people over at ZYD, Zero Youth Detention, Public Health, Seattle, King County, who then send a team there to stop retaliation.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? They send a team there to Harborview to intercept. So there are these resources out there. A lot of them are looked at getting cut, of course. But, you know, so those actions are underway. But with Chief Diaz, so there's the street side of this, the beat cop side of this, but then there's also the internal side of this. We have to remember, like I said, when Chief Best was there, her command staff under her, our reporting shows, quite often sabotaged her. And so, you know, a question I asked Chief Diaz yesterday is how confident are you in the people underneath you, you know what I'm saying, who are going to lead in the right way?
What'd he say?
He said that he has some kind of system down where he's like, constantly interviewing his command staff, constantly making sure that they're on the same page, which is at least something new and different that Chief Best didn't do. And, you know, it worked to Chief Best's detriment because, like I said, the command staff or some of them underneath her definitely worked against her.
And, Hannah, just to wrap up, is the city council on board with this and on board with recruitment efforts, on board with changing the approach in the way that Amari's talking about?
Certainly a good percentage of them are. It looks like there's some support from the public safety chair, Lisa Herbel. Deborah Juarez, the council president, was there at this announcement yesterday. Obviously a fan. We're not sure when that final confirmation vote that is necessary will happen from the council. I believe sometime next month. But I would be shocked to see him not confirmed.
Kearney's writers Hannah Scott and Omari Salisbury of Converge Media. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. Visit BairdSeattle.com. CBS's Kirsten Mitchell has the story of how a neighborhood has come together to honor the lives of beloved pets.
When we walked by, he found a bowl of water and pretty much demolished the entire thing.
On Wilson Street in northeast Minneapolis.
Hey, oh, hello.
Dogs like Murphy are sniffing out something special made just for them.
Pick up toys, pick up leashes, to pick up poop bags, because everyone should pick up their poop, please.
It's a dog library where people can share old items or take what they need.
My neighbors had come over with a little bouquet after I'd lost Charlie just 2.5 weeks ago. And we started talking about getting things out that we could share with other neighbor dogs.
That's when the idea was unleashed.
Really cute dog wallpaper on the tile floor.
And Will Mound got to work fast.
About 3 days.
Really?
Just putzing around in the garage.
Besides the dog library, Will Mound is also known for his creative projects around the neighborhood. He's also made a little free library, and you'll find these little wooden fairy doors speckled all over the area.
It was one of the first rounds of layoffs in the beginning of the pandemic, and it was hard to find work at that time, so I needed something to do, and it was kind of my outlet.
It's not just a love of dogs uniting these neighbors. It's the shared loss of losing a dog over the past year.
We lost our dog, Harold, a little over a year ago.
Dan and Emily lost Hank.
Yeah, it's been nice because, I mean, we all experienced it all at the same time, so we're kind of able to, like, support each other a little bit that way.
And Lisa lost Charlie. Their names are now displayed on the library.
It was very personal and very sweet for me to see Charlie's name up there.
There's just so much out there right now that's negative, so it's kind of nice to feel mm-hmm. something new.
Touching the hearts and the new snouts on Wilson Street.
Everybody's getting new dogs now, so.
That is CBS's Kirsten Mitchell.
7:49, a haze has settled over the city. It's masking the mountains. It's stinking our nostrils. And here is G. Scott from the Junior Ursula Show to tell us how he's going to cope with it today.
Well, I was thought I was getting better. I was escaping the outside into inside Cairo. And so I'm sitting at my desk. I'm like, ooh, you can kind of still smell that. And then they told me I had 2 minutes before I come on with you guys. And then I come in here and nobody warned me. Why does this studio smell this way?
It's like we're trapped in a toaster oven.
How did it get in here?
I know.
It's so we can experience the atmosphere for ourselves.
Yeah.
That way we can describe it to you because it's piped directly into the studio.
So I was just 3 weeks ago talking about this. And I know there's a lot of topics I talk about with Chef and Ursula that I'm sure they just think I'd go crazy. But in this particular topic right here, I was talking about air quality, right? And I was talking about how years ago, I never paid attention and or cared about air quality like I do now. Whenever I fly away from the Pacific Northwest, when I was in Florida during the summer or in New Orleans and all over, every time I fly back here, I am reminded how incredible the air quality is here. So what I said to them 3 weeks ago, I believe that in the future, just like back in the day, we didn't really pay for water, or back in the day, we didn't really pay for television. I think there's going to be a time that you're going to pay for a subscription to air.
To clean air.
To clean air.
Well, they're already selling oxygen, like canned oxygen, so people can get a hit of pure oxygen. But that is a scary thought. I think water is going to be the resource we end up fighting over. But I think you're right. Air quality, you know, I think there are going to be a lot more people wearing masks during the summer season when there's wildfires, because it accumulates over the years and decreases your lung health.
Yo, Colleen, I didn't even used to care about the whole air. 10, 15 years ago, I'd be standing here right now saying, why are you guys complaining? Yo, your boy loves to...
Yeah.
Well, you always smell good, too. You always wear a nice scent. And so I think scent is really important to you.
Yeah. Air is important, too. And I think, you know, you're an entrepreneur. Why don't you just sell bottles of fresh air? We sell bottles of fresh water.
There are influencers who sell canned other things.
You could actually have air, like we have water pipes now. In the future, we'll have air pipes to pipe fresh air into the house.
Ooh. Let's practice. Dave Ross, good morning, sir.
Good morning, G.
Brother, I got that good air. Yeah. I'm talking about that good air to go have you right. Have you right. I'm talking about you going to get a good quality sleep,
I have fresh air from France, bottled at the source.
Oh, really?
In Provence.
I mean, can you prove it? can you prove it's not bootleg?
Otherwise, it's just sparkling air.
As someone who buys Louis Vuitton and Gucci and all that, sometimes folks got that bootleg. This ain't no bootleg
air. You don't
have
that tap air, do you? Come on.
Still air.
I got that carbonated air.
Yeah, but Dave, I'm asking you, though, is air a big deal to you, older you've gotten?
Yeah, that's why I carry this in my pocket, so if it gets too bad, I just slip it over my face. It's called a mask.
I thought that was going to be a handkerchief.
I thought it was too to blow his nose.
Do you guys remember, like, my dad, does anybody's, or if you're listening, maybe you still carry one, and no disrespect towards you, but my dad, he carried a handkerchief all the time.
I think it's still the cutest thing.
It is the nastiest thing in the world.
To me, it's cute because it's just sort of like remnants of a bygone era where you carried like handkerchiefs that your wife may have, crocheted little stuff on the edges and put your initials
in. Colleen, it was
so cute.
It was he did have his initials in there.
Right?
In 2016, like, he was still doing it and still folding it and putting it.
He's trying to save the earth.
Now, my dad did that too. We didn't have Kleenex back then.
It was toilet paper, though.
Sometimes I remember the kid when his grandkids came along. You know, they would sometimes get the sniffles, and Dad would reach for his handkerchief.
Oh no!
And Mom would say, "No, don't take that thing."
My dad would do the same thing to me sometimes.
Really? Oh, like a clean. Now my kids just reach. Like if I'm wearing a cardigan, they'll just take the edge of the cardigan and wipe their nose.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You become a human Kleenex when you become a mom.
I gotta say, I'd rather see a kid do that than see my father, God rest his soul, grab a handkerchief for the fifth time in an hour. And you can only fold it so many times, Dad. Okay.
Yeah. Brief safe, G. Yeah.
See you guys. You can ring my bell. Ring the bell. This is Seattle's Morning News, and it's time to talk about men who want to be taller. Don't know how that feels, but let's bring in Rachel Bell to talk about this operation. I had no idea this was going on.
Neither have I, and I actually felt sick to my stomach reading this article, and I looked over and you looked a little bit green as well. This story comes from GQ, so I think we're more used to women making surgical changes to their body. For years, women have gotten their breasts done, nose jobs, facelifts, now Botox, which is a little bit different, but you don't hear about men getting cosmetic surgery as often, and the latest trend, I mean, it's still pretty small, but hundreds of men are starting to get it, is having your legs lengthened so you can be either 3 or 6 inches taller.
That's a lot.
But the surgery is so painful and so invasive and so gross that I don't understand why anyone would put themselves through this just because of an insecurity. Because I'm perfect and I don't have any insecurities.
I know. So I was like, as a woman, you don't understand insecurities.
Wait till you listen to this surgery, though. So what they do is they break both of your femur. They are flexible and sturdy like bone, says the article. And the size of a piccolo, which I thought was a very cute little reference. But that piccolo is big.
Yeah.
These are big nails. Then, just like when you would have braces, you know, they would tighten them every time to move your teeth. But these nails are tightened 1 millimeter every day for 3 months. Via a magnetic remote control. And then once the broken bones heal, which takes a year, you are taller. So
let's be clear. They're not so much tightened as expanded. So they're separating the broken bones.
And
so
new bone grows.
So the new bone grows to fill the gap. So it's all natural bone.
Yes.
And eventually they take off these things, right? So that your legs are finally exposed and you can look normal again.
You just have a bunch of puncture wounds.
But you have a bunch of puncture wounds in your legs.
And they point out that it is extremely painful. Not only is the bone being stretched, but they say, quote, the extension of the nail stretches the nerves and tissues around the bones, especially the thick, meaty muscles like the hamstrings, to an almost excruciating degree. They feature a guy in the article named John. This is the part that gets me. This guy was 5'8 to begin with. Now he's 5'11 and a half. He couldn't walk for months. It's been 8 months. He still has a limp, and he's supposed to be using crutches. And the interesting part is, you know, they say in this article, most of us are doing it for ourselves, not for anyone else. Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Right.
90% of patients don't tell anybody that they had this done. They lie. They say, I had a ski accident.
Yeah, accident.
One guy blamed it on the COVID vaccine.
Oh, no. That's terrible.
That he grew 6. Because this one other guy, he started at 5'4". You have some explaining to do when you're 6 inches taller.
Absolutely.
You're 5'10 all of a sudden. That's a huge difference.
I don't know. Did they explain the long-term pain associated with breaking the femur? Because as somebody who a year and a half ago had just a hairline fracture in my wrist, I still, if I overuse this wrist lifting heavy things, lifting my children, it reverberates for a couple of days. Just this pain in my wrist.
Well, these guys they must be desperate. I mean, they get painkillers, right, which you're supposed to take at a certain regimen.
But we're talking
addicted,
a year and a half after my bone healed.
These guys are really desperate because they felt oppressed because the women wouldn't date them, and they read these statistics saying that if you're taller, you make more money over your lifetime.
Oh, that's one of the things they talk about, because this guy, John, not only was he 5'8", but I got the impression he was partner. He has 3 kids and he has a job already. But yeah, he said, people are already looking at me more at the gym. And then a lot of the guys, of course, they feel like it hurts their dating life to be shorter. I mean, I understand. Of course, I have insecurities and there's things that I don't love about myself, but I would never put myself through this kind of
a year of pain
and surgery. And then the other thing they point out is that you actually look strange because it's not proportional.
Right.
So it's just your thighs
just
that are longer.
Yes.
You got short calves.
And so if you do the femur, that's a 3-inch growth. If you want the 6-inch, then after the year and after you've healed from the femur, then they do your tibia, and that is another 3 inches. So then you are stretched even stranger.
Mm.
So they said when you are naked, you look odd. Yeah.
Can you explain, because, you know, as I said earlier, as a woman, I understand insecurities intimately, right? Like our whole lives, society is telling us everything that's wrong with us. Men get that to a certain extent. I think hair growth for men is a big one. Height for men is a big one. I'm not sure if anything else comes up Dave, as far as, you know, insecurities for men, but what is that pressure like, and why would men go to this length?
Well, I mean, the reason I'm in radio is because I'm short.
Yeah?
Come on.
Yeah. That was the one place where I could sound taller and, you know, more manly and assertive.
What would you be doing if you were taller?
I'd be a quarterback, star. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, so it changed the trajectory of your life.
But here's the thing that got me about this article. It seems to be... There's a little bit of judgmentalism in the article, but there's not nearly as much controversy about this as there would be over gender surgery, right?
Right.
I mean, that's like a big deal. That's this horrible thing. And yet these guys, apparently for years, have been getting their legs artificially lengthened.
And that's not against God's, you know, order.
Exactly.
That's a good point. He did mention it's mostly their word, not mine, tech bros.
Tech bros,
of course. Yeah. Well, all that money, and what are you going to do with it?
That makes sense.
Grow some legs.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.